وبركاته.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
The spotlight.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
The U.S. military has carried out a strike in Syria's Deir al-Zor against what it called infrastructure facilities used by groups affiliated with Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Iran's official reaction, it denied having any links to sites targeted by the U.S. in Syria. Why does the U.S., who's occupying Syrian soil, believe that it can target anything inside Syria? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the volatile situation in Syria, in particular northern Syria, created due to the U.S. illegal presence there, and the significance of the timing of U.S. strikes coming at a time when U.S. and Iran are engaged in the JCPOA revival talks. First, let's get an update from our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who joins us from Damascus. Mohammed, at this point, to give us a recap about these strikes that have occurred, that the U.S. actually executed, it seems like 24 hours ago.
Yes, yesterday the United States carried out a strike on a location in Deir al-Zor province, claiming it was targeting an area where there is a group linked to Iran over there. However, Iran rejected that claim as false, and this is not the first time that the United States carries out such a strike. Yes, but just last year there was a similar one. This U.S. strike comes just recently after one of its bases in Syria, in Al-Tanf area, was hit over there and was subjected to a drone attack. Of course, no one claimed responsibility for that attack at that time. Now, what is interesting is what the statement of the United States said with regards to the goal of this strike. It said that it is aimed at protecting the U.S. forces inside Syria. And here, if you ask analysts, it's interesting to hear such a statement, because what the United States is trying to do is to tell the world, or portray to the world, that it is in a state of self-defense. Well, the reality is the opposite. The United States is not in a state of self-defense. It is attacking the civilians, attacking the Syrian people, striking their homes, looting its resources, the oil, for example, inside Syria, dividing the country by supporting so-called SDFA and giving them hope for a creating some kind of a statelet. So all of the practices of the United States in Syria are illegal. It is occupying the country, and it's targeting any side that actually fights terrorism, while it's claiming that it itself is fighting terrorism, which is opposite to the reality on the ground.
Thank you very much for that, Mohammed Ali, of course, one of them from Damascus. At this point, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Our guest, Sarah Flounder, joins us. She's the co-director of the International Action Center from New York. Also joining us is Ken Stone, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sarah Flounders, I'm going to first start with you and ask you a simple question about why we're looking at, or Kent Stone, I guess we're starting with you first. I'm sorry. Kent Stone, looking at the strike that has taken place, it wasn't a simple operation. According to reports, there were 8 U.S. fighter jets, 4 which were composed of 4 F-16 and 4 F-19E. Doesn't sound like a very simple operation there. I believe Sarah Flounders then is with us for this question. And it was reported 9 targets were hit in Syria. Why do you think at this point this has been carried out, Sarah Flounders, by the U.S.?
Well, first of all, it's an absolutely illegal attack and an outrageous attack on Syria's sovereignty. But at this time, what is most threatening to the U.S. government is peace. The very idea that Turkey may be entering into discussions with Syria, that there might be a change among all the forces in the region in their attitude towards Syria, is absolutely threatening to the U.S. And it's also a time when the countries of the world who want to move forward with the JCPOA, that's threatening to the U.S. While officially they claim to be for it, they are not for peace anywhere. They need war, and they will use their vast, air force, their whole armadas, in order to constantly instigate wars.
But the response here has been, Ken Stone, that this U.S. attack, and I'm quoting Iran, on Syrian infrastructure and people, a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The sites that were targeted had no links to the Islamic Republic. Do you believe the way that the U.S. is using the association of anything inside Syria with Iran to be, first of all, a valid reason for the U.S. to target what it claims to be Iran-backed groups or anything associated with IRGC at this point?
I do not think it's a valid reason. The government of Iran is an ally of the Syrian government. The Syrian government under President Bashar al-Assad invited the Iranian government to send armed forces to Syria to help protect it against the regime change operation that was launched under the auspices of the U.S. to overthrow the government of Syria and to carve up Syria into various little statelets, the better to gobble them up. This is part and parcel of the U.S. agenda all over the world. The U.S. does not recognize the territorial integrity of other countries or their sovereignty, and routinely, since the Second World War, has been at war with one country or other in the world. And in Syria, they have been trying to overthrow the government since the mid-1970s. The first sanctions, U.S. sanctions against Syria, I think, were 1972. The preparations for the regime change operation, which started under the auspices of the U.S. and its coalition of partners, began with a shooting operation, a shooting war in 2011, the preparations started in 2005 and 2006. Since the shooting war started, the U.S. has supported armed terrorist groups inside of Syria, including Daesh, which we call ISIS here in North America. And they have supported, they have created a number of illegal military bases, including the bump at Al Tanf base over the border from Jordan, And in eastern Syria, the U.S. Has conducted out-and-out occupation for the past few years, sitting on the oil fields, as Trump said, to take the oil and gas, but also in an alliance with the SDF, a Turkish separatist outfit that's seeking to carve a Kurdish state out of parts of Syria, Iraq, Iran, Turkey. So the U.S. routinely in Syria and around the world has been disrespecting other countries' sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, Sarah Flanders, the U.S. has come out and said that these strikes that were exercised 24 hours ago, they were actually necessary because they were meant to protect and defend U.S. personnel. Now, that it's pretty ironic for the U.S. to say that when it's on Syrian soil without the invitation of Bashar al-Assad, and is there violating, as our guest there said, Syria's sovereignty, and yet it claims that it's to protect American personnel. How is that possible for the U.S. To say that? And then who's the buyer of that stance?
There is no basis for any U.S. forces to be in Syria, be bombing Syria, to be running camps of terrorists in Syria, and they run, at this point, still 19 camps, to be stealing Syrian oil, which they are doing in thousands of container trucks that move across Syria. None of this has any basis in legality. It's absolute piracy. It's an effort to dismember Syria. It's an effort to actually break up the whole region. It is also aimed at Iran, who is there, as Ken very accurately said, at the invitation of the Syrian government and has given real solidarity and assistance. Now, the U.S. has a regime change plan for Iran, too, and they want to inflame all the relations in the region and are threatened by any effort of the countries of the region to come to an agreement, even to come to a ceasefire. They're threatened by that, and they will use their war instruments. And in this case, you know, F-16s, F-15Es, those aren't small. That's not a drone attack. This is really U.S. fighter jets bombing Syria. And they have done that since 2015, and they have imposed sanctions in an effort to destabilize Syria for decades. So every step of this is completely illegal, an attack on the sovereignty of Syria and an effort to destabilize the entire region. There's no legal basis for it whatsoever, and yet they will always assert this is part of some rules-based order. What that rule is simply the U.S. is supposed to rule, and that is being challenged. That certainly is being challenged.
Well, the mere presence of the U.S. on Syrian soil, on the one hand, and for it to have a military base in Al-Tanf is what the U.S. has cited to be the reason when it was attacked by a drone, I guess, for what happened 24 hours ago, Kent Stone. You talked about how this Al-Tanf has been reported to train terrorists and for it to have U.S. either direct or indirect cooperation with these terrorists or terrorist groups that operate in and out of this camp. Tell us more about that, because that is something that both Iran and Russia have accused the U.S. when it comes to this particular Al-Tanf garrison, which is used by the U.S. forces.
Well, Al-Tanf is on the Jordanian border, but it's there's a bump now since 2011 onto the Syrian side. And on the Syrian side, the camp, the enlargement of the camp, which is totally illegal and a violation of the sovereignty of the Syrian people, is being used to train Daesh terrorists for renewed attacks on Syria. As you know, the Syrian government, with the help of Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Russian government, managed to defeat about 90% Syria. The U.S. has started to use the Al-Tanf base to reorganize the disparate groups of terrorists, Islamic terrorists that it has supported, and it's using that base to try and encourage further incursions and destabilization in the western part of western and southern parts of Syria. The Russians have said that as well, and the Russians have attacked that base twice with planes in the last month, and they have even notified the U.S. in advance of these attacks and told them where they were coming and why they were attacking the base. And I believe that the Russians were delivering a message to the Americans saying, we are not going to tolerate much longer your training of terrorists inside of Syria to destabilize our Syrian ally.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a great point that you make there about the Russian involvement. And Sarah Flounders, I'd like to find out what is going on there when it comes to Russia. Russia has said, it's being, as our guest there explained fully, about Al-Tanf, how U.S. uses the training of Daesh terrorists there. But it seems like Russia has stepped up its not only actions about targeting those terrorists there, but also being very vocal about the fact that, you know, the U.S. should discontinue doing what it's doing. Do you think that Russia is now in this mode where it will continue on this path, targeting areas around Al-Tanf, some deducting that that perhaps is a message also to U.S. when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, certainly it is linked, because the hope that some accommodation with U.S. could be reached no longer exists in Russia today. And so in the past, there was an effort to do two things and use diplomacy and so on very often. But now it's clear that the effort is to dismember Russia and to use NATO and to hack away in totally destructive ways. That's one step. It's a lot to do also with sabotaging the JCPOA, the very idea that the U.S. would, a treaty they signed the Security Council, all the countries of the world supported it, and it was the U.S. who ripped it up. So it means any of the treaties that they wouldn't expand NATO, every agreement, treaty that they have made, they are violating now more aggressively than ever. And because their influence is waning in the region and globally, they are more and more forced to use the only power they have, which is substantial, and that is their military power. Now, Russia today is challenging that and showing, certainly in Ukraine, and also they have the ability to give real assistance to Syria and to the countries of the region. They have military capacity, and that's important to recognize and very helpful for the countries of the region that are trying to survive. So these things are really intensely connected, and there are other countries that are looking at it and stepping back from their alliance, such as Turkey, with NATO, with the U.S., and thinking they should find ways to reach accommodation economically in trade and perhaps also politically. And that would be a real contribution and of assistance to Syria if Turkey's role changed. That's very threatening to the U.S., and they want to do everything they can to break that and to assert themselves. I don't think it'll be very successful. Mm-hmm. It's one more way in which they're really exposed, and it more shows their weakness and their inability to follow any of the agreements they've made.
Well, at the center of this, if you agree, Ken Stone, is the fact that the U.S. is creating instability due to its illegal presence on the ground there in Syria. I think we agree on that. But there's other factors here involved, such as Turkey's role, where it is after the the Kurds, of which the U.S. is backing, of which Turkey is targeting them and says, we want to actually carve out a territory. the simple solution would be for the U.S. to move out of Syria. But it's not doing that. So this instability is actually just continues. And now we see how Turkey is on the offensive again, even though it promised not to go ahead with its, weeks ago when it came to Iran and talked with Iran's leader in Russia's presence. How can this be resolved? I mean, the quick solution, as I stated, is for the U.S. to take off from Syria, but we don't see that happening.
I think that Turkey sent some positive signals to Syria and to the world community in the last few weeks by saying that that it was agreeable to President Putin's request to Mr. Erdogan that Mr. Erdogan find a way to work with President Assad to achieve a political settlement and peace in Syria. And Erdogan was very very vocal about it. He said that he liked the idea and that, in fact, his foreign minister, Mr. Çavuşoğlu, had met the foreign minister of Syria, Mr. al-Mahdad, on the sidelines of the non-aligned meeting last October, and that there was already contact between the intelligence services of both countries. Nonetheless, Turkey sent planes and attacked Syria, and three Syrian army soldiers were killed, and six more were wounded. And I feel that Turkey, like the UAE and other countries in the region, have made moves to stop the isolation of Syria and to restore diplomatic relations, bring Syria into the Arab League and back into the Arab League and so forth. However, I'm not sure that this kind of rapprochement can take place between Turkey, which after all was one of the biggest players in the invasion and this destabilization of Syria since 2011. I'm not sure there can be a rapprochement as long as the U.S. is sitting on the eastern third of Syria, where it supports the Kurdish separatists who attack Turkey and create a cycle of violence that Turkey, in exchange, attacks Syria. I think, as you pointed out, the overall solution is for the U.S. to get out of Syria now. And I think that I'm hopeful, and okay, other people in the peace movement are hopeful, that once the special military operation in Ukraine is finished, that the Russian government will turn its attention to the Middle East and especially Syria and put the necessary pressure on the U.S. to get out of Syria and stop destabilizing the entire region with its presence there.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Sarah Flounder is co-director of the International Action Center from New York. Ken Stone, thank you so much. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitahue and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the charitable nature of Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's lesson, I want to talk about the charity of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. This was a quality that Al-Imam Al-Hussein portrayed and he had during his lifetime, during the period that he lived in this world. Charity was one of the greatest qualities of the father of humanity, Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam, because his eminence was the refuge of the poor and the destitute and the support of everyone who was going through hard times. And his eminence used to satisfy and please all those who approached him for help. Now, Kamaluddin bin Talha says that it had become famous that His Eminence used to welcome guests with great respect and gave to anyone who asked him anything. Anyone who came for help to him, Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam did his best and tried so much he could, he helped them directly. So he used to be kind to his relatives. He used to help those who appealed him for it. Now, he provided clothes to the needy. He fed the hungry people. He forgave his debtors, the one who took debts from him. He forgave them. He helped the weak. He was so much concerned also for the orphans and make the needy ones needless. So whenever he received any funds, he used to distribute them to the needy. This was how much charitable Imam Hussein was. He was he used to practice a lot the quality of charity. He used to give a lot. Now, these good qualities of kindness, charity, and the benevolence are such that only those having the perfect morals possess it. Al-Imam Hussein here describes and he portrays to us that he is having the best of the morals. He is perfect in terms of his morals. And indeed, he's showing us that his grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, taught him well. Thank you so much for listening. We're coming back in a few minutes.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
So welcome back again. We're talking about the charity, the quality of charity in Aba Abdullah alayhi salam. He was such a leader who had this particular quality, and he used to give a lot. He used to share a lot to the needy. Whoever needed help from him, he was helping him to the full capacity. The historians are stating that His Eminence Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam carried sacks full of bread and victuals and some money in the darkness of the night on his shoulders to homes of widows. You know, he used to help widows. So he used to carry all these bags of money and bread and food, and he used to carry it around in the night so that they wouldn't even know that he's helping them. So he used to carry these bags to the doors of the houses, and he was sharing it to them. Now, he was also carrying all these things to the orphans, the houses of the orphans and the destitute, you know, till it left scars on his shoulders. You know, his shoulders had scars because he used to carry, like, you know, a bag that used to have food in it, and he was, you know, sharing it around. This was how he portrayed his charity. This how Imam Hussein portrayed that he's really owning this particular quality of charity. He used to give a lot, and this is what our leaders or anyone of this time who is reading about the life of Imam Hussein needs to teach himself from these particular qualities. Thank you so much for listening. Inshallah, until next episode, we'll meet again. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has highlighted the stance of the resistance front in addition to the significant achievements accomplished in the past 40 years.
One of our duties in the future is to strengthen the strategies of deterrence to protect Lebanon's people, land, state, sovereignty and dignity, and natural resources and treasures.
The most pressing matter awaiting the resistance, he said, was the issue of maritime resources.
The main and current challenge that we're facing now and the few upcoming days is the issue of gas and petrol and the demarcation of the maritime borders. I will not say anything new. We have said everything that we should say. Now we're all waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, We always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma Al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 53 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with Israeli officials and military forces. Hundreds of people attended the national conference, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Tel Aviv regime against crossing the red lines at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound.
We warned the Zionist enemy against making any stupid moves towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds. We're willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on all Arab leaders to boycott the Israeli regime because it poses a great threat to all nations.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinian officials accused Arab regimes normalizing ties with Tel Aviv of encouraging Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The shameful normalization of ties between Arab countries and the Israeli regime is encouraging our enemy to carry out further attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Arab governments must stop encouraging the Israeli regime to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and their sacred sites. Al-Quds is the core of the Palestinian struggle.
This year's anniversary comes amid an escalation in Israeli attacks against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims and Palestinians who consider it as the capital of their future state.
Al-Quds will always be in the heart of the Islamic nation, and all attempts by the Israeli regime to change its status are doomed to fail. On this sad occasion, we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support Al-Quds and to support Palestine.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice. Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against the Al-Aqsa Mosque for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A timeless beauty that tells stories from Iran's rich artistic heritage. Persian carpets are on display in the 29th Iranian Handwoven Carpet Show in Tehran. The event has brought under one roof producers of hand-woven carpets and pictorial rugs from across the country to showcase their latest designs.
The Persian carpet represents the identity of Iranians. Today, you can see machine-made carpets which are significantly lower in quality compared to the hand-woven ones. So this expo helps reintroduce the importance of hand-woven rugs to the people.
For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented Iran's culture and art. Its unique design and quality have turned the ancient handicraft into a lucrative commodity on the global stage. Less than three decades ago, this sublime art used to be a major export earner for Iran, a viable source of income that accounted for almost one-fifth of the country's non-oil revenues. But today, this is no longer the case, as producers are warning that the Iranian carpet is losing its shine in the global market. From an annual revenue of up to $1 billion in the 1990s, the export of Iranian carpets has slumped to almost zero. One reason behind this freefall has to do with U.S. sanctions, says carpet trader who used to export to Europe before Washington's anti-Iran measures tightened the screw on the Persian carpet.
In the wake of the sanctions, it's safe to say that our carpet exports have dropped to almost zero. Complications in money transfer are one of the impacts of the sanctions, and the unwillingness of foreign clients to buy from us is the other result, because they fear U.S. punishment if they interact with us.
In 2018, another challenge came into play to knock the Persian carpet out of the global market once and for all. Surprisingly, it's a domestic issue. Since the depreciation of the Iranian rial, the government has imposed tight controls on currency liquidity, which require exporters to return their hard currency proceeds to the country within a very short period of time.
The government is not helping us, yet it's been creating problems for us by the so-called currency treaty. It's impossible to return the proceeds within only 2 months. We need time to sell our carpets in foreign countries where demand for our hand-woven carpets has declined.
The absence of genuine Iranian carpets in the international market has given way to other rivals to fill the void. Countries such as India, Pakistan, and even Afghanistan have since been supplying the market with cheap and fake copies of Iranian carpets, says this young carpet trader.
India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, they are just representing their tableau rugs and carpets with lower prices. The density of their carpets are lower than Iranian carpets, the colors. And also, if you just use them in your houses, you can see that their colors are faded by passing the time.
Representing Iran's heritage and civilization for thousands of years, the Persian carpet has for the past two decades disappeared from many floors and walls. Producers hope that this exhibition would act as a wake-up call for Iranian authorities to take action and dust off all the challenges from the Persian carpet. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels. Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony of human beings is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
Thank you.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the U.S. and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the U.S. doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the U.S. sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The U.S. should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor Afghan people? Both sides have had their battle and agreement. Today, the U.S. is stealing that piece of bread of ours which was supposed to fill the stomachs of our children. Why is the U.S. creating this dire situation which everyone is hungry and poor? In addition, we have been the victims of the terrorism and we can't pay the price for 9/11.
Majority of the Afghan population is in need of humanitarian assistance. More than half of Afghans are going hungry, and more than 1 million children are severely malnourished. The humanitarian situation in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day, and the country needs its frozen funds for an economic recovery. It remains to be seen when Washington opens its eyes on the miseries of Afghans and returns their money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in the Malian capital, Bamako, on the first leg of his African tour, which will later take him to Tanzania and Zanzibar. Amir Abdollahian is heading a high-ranking political and economic delegation. A group of representatives of several private sector companies also accompanies him during his visit. The top diplomat was welcomed by his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop. Upon arrival at Bamako's international airport, the Malian foreign minister called the visit a sign of Iran's will to enhance ties with the African country. Amir Abdullahian confirmed that Tehran seeks all-out expansion of relations with Mali and has special plans for this purpose.
I am confident that we will start a new chapter of relations between Tehran and Mali under the government of President Raisi.
The visit is part of a wider policy roadmap in Iran. The foreign ministry says Tehran is looking to expand ties with African nations, including Mali, in the fields of economy, banking, and trade.
Mahdi Abbasian, Bamako.
In the limelight.
The former New York mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, has been told that he is the target of the investigation concerning whether Donald Trump and his associates tried to illegally influence the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. The article you're about to hear has been written by Richard Fawcett, a New York Times correspondent and former Los Angeles Times reporter. The article has been published by the New York Times and is titled, Giuliani Appears Before Atlanta Grand Jury Investigating Trump. Rudolph W. Giuliani, the former lawyer for Donald J. Trump and a target in the criminal investigation into Mr. Trump's efforts to overturn Georgia's results in the 2020 presidential election, spent hours behind closed doors on Wednesday taking questions as part of a special grand jury proceeding. But a lawyer for Mr. Giuliani declined to say whether he answered any of those questions. It is unclear what crimes Mr. Giuliani could be charged with in the sprawling investigation of Mr. Trump and his allies being led by Fannie Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia. Rudolph Giuliani, a 78-year-old, made numerous false claims about election fraud after the November 2020 election in Georgia state legislative hearings. He also participated in a scheme to create slates of fake presidential electors in 2020 in numerous states, including in Georgia. That is now the subject of an intensifying investigation by the Justice Department. Legal experts said Mr. Giuliani, who, as a target of the inquiry, could eventually face indictment, might have declined to answer many or most of the questions posed to him on Wednesday, either by invoking attorney-client privilege or his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Mr. Giuliani indicated that he was likely to invoke attorney-client privilege in an interview this week with Newsmax, the far-right news outlet. If Mr. Giuliani left most questions unanswered, his appearance in Atlanta, Georgia, would have echoed Mr. Trump's marathon session at a deposition earlier this month in Manhattan, New York, in which the former president invoked his Fifth Amendment right more than 400 times, as part of an investigation into his company's business practices. If those appearances underscore the legal peril the two men may face, other developments in the Georgia case highlight the combustible political atmosphere in which it is being conducted. On Wednesday, 17th of August, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican who resisted Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his Georgia defeat, filed a motion to quash a subpoena to appear before the special grand jury. Among other things, Brian Kemp argued that it was unfair that he might be called to testify in the midst of his heated re-election contest against his Democratic rival, Stacey Abrams. On Tuesday, 16th of August, 11 of the 16 pro-Trump alternate electors from Georgia filed a motion seeking to have Fannie Willis, a Democrat, disqualified from the investigation because she headlined a fundraiser for a Democrat running for lieutenant governor. All 16 of these Republican electors have been identified as targets of the investigation by Fulton County prosecutors. And U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Republican, said this week that he would appeal a federal judge's order that he appear before the special grand jury, arguing that his required participation